the whole experience of sweating out a human life. What does the Divine Son know about balancing a budget? You know, cash in, coming out, go. And yet Jesus had an experience of being head of his deceased father's household. And you remember when times were kind of rough, they didn't have enough for 3 squares a day. They saved the best food for the evening meal. And that makes sense. Who wants to go to bed hungry? If they were going to be hungry, they were going to be hungry during the day. They always managed a square meal at night. What does the Divine Son know about the fact that his brothers are going to get educated, but the gals aren't deemed to be fit for education? He had to set up a home school. What would Michael up on Paradise know about the consequences of drawing teacher's picture on the classroom floor when it says, thou shalt make no graven image? He broke one of the commandments. Interesting thought that Jesus broke one of the Ten Commandments. He drew a picture, and a good Jew drew no picture. That was the interpretation of the Mosaic injunction. Yes, thou shalt make no graven image. Moses was trying to make sure there was nothing idolatrous, and that was strictly interpreted. That's why in a Jewish or a Mohammedan temple, you will find nothing but geometric design, or design such as Burke has on our curtains here. But you mustn't make a picture of anything. Yeah. Yeah. Now, Jesus learned a great deal down here that Michael never knew. Michael suspected these things.
Well, Bill, that's one of the things you say that a finite match means, like you were talking about and the finite natives here and the Habona natives, they're all, they're both finite, but one was created with a perfection and one worked his way up. In
right.
Other words,
we work our way up.
We will have a much more appreciative, I would think, but I don't think that that's true, but I would think that the finite native that worked his way up made the mistake, fell down the skinny things and things, would appreciate Havana much more than someone that has stuck there and had it all their life.
Right, right. They tell us this. They tell us that when human beings get to paradise, finally, and complete the paradise training regime, they're given a chance to worship. And they say, never yet have the native beings native to paradise ever correctly calculated how much worshiping we want to get out of our system. We always have more than they can understand. And that's because they cannot understand what we've come up through. It's not their fault. They just never had that experience. And of course, if it weren't for them, we wouldn't have the help that we need to get there. Let's stop and think what happens to them. We are a challenge to them just as much as they are a challenge to us. God challenges them to help us just as much as he challenges us to become like them. God challenges his creator sons. In effect, he says, now let's see if you can make a perfect universe. Here's the pattern. Can you create and evolve a universe which in its way will be just as perfect as Havona is? And that's what Jesus has set out to do out here in time and space. And that's a real undertaking. That's just as big a challenge to him as a creator as God's personal challenge to us, where he said, be you perfect, even as I am perfect. That's the tough challenge we have to measure up to. It's quite formidable. No, Goldie, the Supreme Being to me is a very important person. When I'm stuck down in the future, and I just am up against God's infinity, and it keeps on making me dizzy, just like it does now. I'm going to get a real comfort out of thinking about the Supreme Being. I'm going to say, even if I can't understand the Father, I can know the Father and love Him and worship Him, but I can't understand Him. But here is another aspect of God that I can understand. That's going to be very helpful. Just as right now, it helps me a great deal. I can't understand God, but I can understand the human Jesus. I understand budgets. I understand carpentry. I understand going to school. I understand drawing teacher's picture on the floor. I understand all the things that happened to him as a boy, a young man, and even some of the things in his public life, the more human side. There's some divine things he did that are beyond him. But the human part of him, I understand. I could be friends with that man. If he came in and sat down with us tonight, let's say dressed normally, let's say in a sports shirt, and he dressed the way we folks dress, I think we'd find him very friendly. I don't think we'd be in the least afraid of him. I think he'd be a lot of fun to be with. Secondary supreme finite integration means what the Supreme Being is going to do to the seven super universes when they are finally perfected. He's going to rule them. And he's going to rule them because he is like them. He is evolutionary as they are evolutionary. He's finite as they are finite. He has earned his status as a sovereign, even as they have earned their status as perfected creation.
Well,
Bill, the
seven
super
universes
want all seven
to be
perfected. Probably not. You know, I'll bet you we're the laggard. Number seven. I think they will hit perfection relatively close together. Now that might be hundreds and hundreds of millions of years apart, but comparatively speaking, it won't be too far apart. I imagine that's true in the local universe. Some one planet's going to hold the thing up, you know. Maybe we'll be the one that'll be the laggard in our local universe, because we've got a long ways to go. In fact, when you stop and think that they got to perfect this planet along with the rest of them, this gives you kind of a feeling for what a tough job it is. Yes, I have a feeling of compassion. And you see, they can't get arbitrary because God has given us freedom of choice. And they don't dare monkey with our choosing. Because if they try to monkey with our choosing, they're working contrary to the will of God. And they've just got to leave us alone. And if we want to make damn fools out of ourselves, God has given us the power to do that. And nobody can tell us no. We're strictly on our own. Now, it gets a little bit tougher from here on out, because we're going into the future. And I've got to backtrack now, because I've got to put a new trinity together. And we're missing one member we haven't talked about. Let's go way back to about where these circles are getting pulled apart. At about that time, God is making plans. He hasn't done anything yet, but he's planning. Can you visualize this? And these plans are real, as plans. He's planning the whole master universe. He's thinking it through. What does a developer of a subdivision do when he thinks about opening up that subdivision? He gets out some paper and he sketches out the whole thing, doesn't he? Where the streets are going to be, the sewers, the lights, and all of that. God is going to open up a subdivision in infinity. The name of that subdivision is the Master Universe. And so just so that we can really get this understandable, let's visualize God sketching out these plans. Because, you know, we've got to humanize this in order to understand it. Only, God doesn't actually sketch out any plans. I think when he thinks through his plans for the Master Universe, I think these plans come alive. And let's think of them as living blueprints, living architect's drawings. And the name of these living blueprints, these living architect's drawings, are the architect of the Master Universe. What a blueprint is to an architect, to an engineer or a planner, these architects are to God. They're not creators. The creators are like the contractors that later come in and build houses, the many mansions in my father's house. But these are the boys that come in before the contractors and lay out the streets, put in the sewers, get the lighting in, get the power lines in. Because a contractor can't work until you have a subdivision, can you? All right? These architects of the Master Universe are the developers of the subdivision. There are going to be six of them. Havona was the first one. We're the second. There are going to be four more space levels coming out from where we are. Think of each of these space levels as one of the subdivisions of infinity. And the architects of the Master Universe are the developers of the subdivision, the people who get ready for the creators who come in to build the houses. Michael is a contractor. He comes in to build houses. He builds some mansions in his father's house. These architects are the bosses of the Master Force organizers that come out here and get nebulae started. There's no use for Michael to come out here until he's got a physical universe to work with. And our universe was gotten underway and chugged along for almost 600 billion years before Michael arrived. And he came out here and there was a big physical bunch of nebulae disintegrating with suns and planets, something to work with. Physics. These architects have in mind all of God's plans for the central universe, the super universes, and the outer universe. Are we getting? Now we've got something new that we've got to think about. Let me see here. Yeah. That's right. Just want to be sure I'm following the paper. When the Supreme Being appears, and when all the contractors have finished building their local universes, I suspect that God says to them, now why don't all you boys get together and you pick it up from here? You've had some experience now. And why don't you subdivision planners, new contractors who build houses, and the supreme being, who's the mayor, why don't you get together now and form a council? And you take it from here. We've gotten this thing started now. And he says, just so that we can get this thing real simple, the mayor, of course, is one person. He tells all the architects, he says, you get an attorney, in fact, to speak for all of you, because there's 28,000 of you, us. And he says to the contractors, there's over a million of them, he says, you get an attorney, in fact, too. And then you can sit down with the mayor and both of your attorney, in fact, and you can set up a little council here. And you carry the development now into the outer universe. And it's the supreme being and these two attorneys, in fact, that make up the first experiential trinity, or the trinity ultimate, that can collaborate with the original trinity. This is something new, a trinity in which experience is present, as well as innate perfection. And now we're off and running, because this means opening up real big subdivisions, because these outer space levels are tremendously larger than the whole of the grand universe, or the seven super universes. We figured that if you would think of a tennis ball, can you visualize a tennis ball? Put it in the middle of Burke's living room, right spang in the middle. And then consider the living room. That's about how much bigger the first outer space level is than the seven super universes. And just keep on thinking that way. If you want to think of the first outer space level as the tennis ball, then the living room would represent the second outer space level. These things go up in multiples of 100 at least. By one calculation, I get a multiple of 10,000. By another calculation, I get a multiple of 100. I picked 100 because the number is too tough even with that smaller factor. But if I've made a mistake, I'm getting them too small. I don't think I'm getting them too big. This is the council, or trinity, that's going to operate the opening up of the outer space level. And this is important to us because we're going out into those outer space levels to do a job. And the job we've got to do is very much like the job which the folks from the central universe have done with us. These outer space levels and all the beings that grow up out there are going to know nothing about finite experience, because they can't. It's all been used up. And it can be used up because it is finite. It has an end. And anything that can come to an end, you can use up. The supreme being has completed his growth. You can't grow along with him anymore, can you? It's finished. It's just like the end of a football game. When they blow the last whistle, you're through scoring. Whatever the score is, that's it. That's the record. We're going to go out into these outer universes and work. And we're going to try to help those folks out there. We're going to try to make up to them the fact that they can never have the experience that we've had. And in working for them, we are going to rise above the limitations of finite creatures. You see, at the present time, we have limits that we can't go beyond. The most we can do is to become a perfected finite creature. the most a world can do is to become settled in light and life. That's where the goal line is. And when you cross that goal line, you don't score anymore. I mean, you've had it. This is the limit. But as we work in outer space, they're going to move the goalposts farther away so that we can grow beyond where we can grow now. Just as Michael grew when he came out into time and space, the Universal Father and the Eternal Son made Michael of Nebadon as perfect a creator as they could. But when he came out here, he added a great deal, which they either could not give him, at least they did not give it to him. They made him earn. And just as much as Michael grew, he put experience on top of perfection. So we're going to add something on top of finite perfection. We're going to grow beyond the finite level. When we go into paradise and find God, that's a minimum experience, not a maximum. It's the least that we could understand God and have it count, not the most. Every time we go out and work in another super universe, we're going to come back to paradise as finaliters, and we're going to understand a little bit more about God because we've grown a little more. We go in as a half pint, we get a half pint's worth of experience. We go out and work a while, we come back to paradise as a pint. Now we can get a little more experience. By the time we're a quart, we can get a quart's worth of experience. Someday we'll be a half gallon, then a gallon, maybe a whole hog's head. We're all the time getting acquainted with the Universal Father on the finite level. We're still on the first floor of the firehouse here. But when we break loose into outer space with the help of the Supreme, we're going to move up on the second floor.
In other words, we're going to go out in outer space before we get to the second floor.
That's right.
We're
going to have to earn our way onto the second floor. Yes. When we're in outer space, we're going to start all over again to try to find God the Father. This time we're going to look for him as a super finite Father. We're going to seek for him as an ultimate being. And we can grow on that level because now we're a part of the growth of something new, something bigger than the Supreme. As the Supreme Being is growing in the super universes, so the ultimate is growing in the Master Universe. And when we graduate from growth in the Supreme, we will discover that after we have gotten our sheepskins and are no longer seniors, we will discover that we are freshmen all over again in a larger university. We've gotten out of high school. Now we're going to college. And we're new freshmen on a higher level. Now, this growth is going to take a heck of a lot longer than anything we've been up against. I've done some calculating here, and all I can say is it's probably better than guessing. You know what I mean? It's better than just saying it's a long time. But let me reduce all my calculations down to the simplest terms I can. If growing on the finite level, if it would take an hour to complete all of that growth, then to grow in outer space would take 10,000 years. That's the relationship of time.
How far up do you think we'll go before we have to come back
down? We're never going to come back down because we're never going to lose contact with where we've been.
Well, I mean, you said that we would go out into the outer space level, and that we would have to learn to know God all over in a different sense.
In a higher sense. We don't lose what we've learned.
Will we
ever get grounded?
No. What I meant is, will we have to obtain a Havona before we can go out?
Oh yes, I think we'll come back. We'll come back in through Havona.
We'll have to have so much experience before we can, so much education.
Sure. We'll work out there quite a time, and then I think we'll come in to paradise. And on our way through Havona, we're going to see a lot of things we never saw before, because now we've got better eyesight. Now we're no longer colorblind. We can see in technicolor, to use a real crude illustration, and before we only saw black and white. We're going to see super finite things going on in Havona that have always been going on, but we weren't conscious of. Any more than down here, as human beings, we're conscious of the superhuman life that's on this planet. We're completely oblivious to it. There could be a half a dozen seraphim hanging around this room tonight. We don't know it. Any more than we're conscious of the radio or television waves in this room. Unless we tune in with a proper instrument. And then we can bring them down to where we can perceive them.
In other words, we're going out and out of space levels to
sort
of
pay
back the
whole thing. Exactly. Yes. We will do for those folks what has been done for us here. If our whole finite experience is an hour, and that outer space experience is like 10,000 years in comparison to 1 hour, it's going to take a very long time.
I'm not.
But this too has a limit. The limit is a long ways from here. But the master universe does have an outer rim. There is a place where it ends. And anything that comes to an end can be reached. And eternity, we're not going to run out of eternity. We're not going to run out of time. And sometime, the whole master universe will be finished. That is so long from now that it staggers my imagination. I can't grasp it unless I symbolize it like saying, if it takes an hour to perfect the super universe, then it's going to take 10,000 years to perfect the master universe. But even then, I don't know what 10,000 years is. That's just a heck of a long time. I have no feeling for 10,000 years, you folks. I can't feel much more than, say, about 35 or 40 years. You know, how far back can you remember? Maybe 45 years. Well, fact remains, though, we'll get there. And when the master universe is completed, then the papers tell us that we're going to go through a parallel experience. Like when the super universes were perfected. God the ultimate will emerge when the master universe is completed, just like the supreme being emerges when the super universes are perfected. God the ultimate is bigger than the supreme being, as the master universe is bigger than the super universe. But when we have grown through all of this tremendous experience, we are going to be able to understand God the ultimate just as we understand God the supreme. And this is another way of saying we will also have found the universal Father, not as finite, but the universal Father as ultimate. And now we've gotten to ultimate quartan integration on page 1166. Quartan means fourth. We've been coming up through primary, secondary, tertiary, now quartet. This is not an association, this is an integration. This is an integration by the ultimate, who has completed his growth, and who now has earned the sovereignty of the entire Master Universe. He's earned it in the same way that the Supreme Being earns the sovereignty of the Grand Universe, and as Mike Hill earns the sovereignty of our local universe. And he's going to put this whole thing together, operate it in an understandable way, and we're going to understand it because we've had a chance to grow up with it. And you always understand the business that you grow up with. I don't care how big it gets. If you have a chance to grow with it, you're with it. When God the Ultimate appears, then it's possible to put together another Trinity, the second experiential Trinity. And this Trinity is made up of the Supreme, of the Ultimate, and of a third being that we don't know anything about. He's called the Consummator of Universe Destiny. And he's unrevealed, and he's pretty much undescribed in these papers. And all I can do is gather from that that he's got something to do with getting things finished, if they're finishable. Because the Consummator of Destiny is the guy that gives you a shove across the goal line when you're trying to make a touchdown, like a good blocking tackle, you know what I mean? He's behind you pushing. This Trinity is a tough one to figure out. You see, the first experiential Trinity you can visualize because they've got an objective that's got a limit to it. It's a Master Universe, and it's got an outside. But the second experiential Trinity is going to try to tackle infinity. And that just isn't possible to complete. This is, for the first time, we've hit something now. The next objective doesn't have any outside to it. It's got no goal line. It's a football field, but there's no goal line ahead of it. It's just one that you keep moving down. Or if it's got a goal line, every time you cross it, you discover there's a bigger field on ahead. Maybe that's a better way of looking. This second experiential Trinity is one that, for the first time, we've run out of subdivision. You remember the architects of the Master Universe were going to lay out the Master Universe? We've used up the whole darn subdivision. There isn't any more subdivision. We've got to lay out a new subdivision. And the papers tell us that this subdivision is infinite. And the word infinite means no end, no outside, no beyond, no after. If this second experiential Trinity could lay out this subdivision and complete it and develop it and build all the houses, then they could produce God the Absolute, just like God the Ultimate emerged before. But the big problem is, how can they produce God the Absolute before they build an infinite subdivision? And that's what the paper discusses here in co-absolute or fifth phase association. They're discussing here the problems which are encountered by the second experiential Trinity when they try to go outside of the Master Universe and try to cope with a universe of infinity, or the cosmos infinite, as the papers describe. They go on to one more point. They say, if they could do it, then we would have absolute or sixth phase integration. But they very carefully point out it is not doable. Now, at this point, the papers make a distinction. They say, now, the fact that you can't exhaust infinity from a quantitative standpoint doesn't mean that you can't realize something absolute from a qualitative standpoint. You can get somewhere in quality even though you can't take it all in quantity. Let's say that in words that we can understand. Here's what that means to me. Think of all the air on this planet. It's a lot of it, isn't it? I don't think any human being could breathe at all, even in a whole lifetime, could he? That's just not possible, is it? But that doesn't mean we can't breathe, does it? The mere fact that we can't take in all of something doesn't mean that we can't take in some of it. Let's think about Havona. Havona is a perfect universe. But Havona is not an infinite universe, is it? Havona just takes up just so much space, correct? There are only 1 billion worlds in Havona. 1,000,000,021, if you want to be technical. And no more. Not 1,000,000,022. That's finite. Is Havona finite? From the quantity standpoint, yes. From the quality standpoint, no. The papers instruct me. Havona is partly finite, partly absinite, partly ultimate, partly co-absolute, partly absolute. Qualitatively, Havona is a great deal more than finite. Quantitatively, it's strictly finite in terms of space. Not finite in terms of time, though, because it never had a beginning. Only finite in terms of space. This trinity isn't going to succeed in using up all of infinity. But that doesn't mean it can't use up a part of infinity and keep on working on infinity. It's like having, it's like having a quart and having a tank car full and then having a well that you can't pump dry because the water keeps flowing. You can come to the end of the quart, you can come to the end of the tank car, but you can't ever get all the water out of the well, can you? Because the water keeps coming in. You pump and pump and pump and it's always going to have water. Practically speaking. That, to me, helps me understand how you can keep getting more and more and still you never use it all up. This paper then goes on to talk about finality of destiny. And it points out that we are going to keep on growing along with this ever-widening, expanding universe. That we are never going to be stopped. We have a destiny that we can reach, which is absolute. We're now talking about the third floor of the firehouse. And we are still trying to understand God, only now we're trying to understand God in the final sense of the word. We are trying to understand God as only the eternal Son and the infinite Spirit understand God. And they can understand God because they have infinite capacity to comprehend Him. That is our objective. And we will never attain it. But that doesn't mean we can't get on the third level of the firehouse. We can find God as absolute, qualitatively. But we can never know Him as infinite, quantitatively. In other words, when we find God as absolute, this is an undiluted experience. And we can keep on knowing more and more and more about Him as an absolute God, but never can we know all about Him as an absolute God. If we could know all about Him, then we would understand God as infinite. But the mere fact that we cannot understand all of God does not mean that we can understand nothing of God on the absolute level. Now, how the heck can we get up there on the absolute level and work? There are two reasons the papers tell us why we can. First of all, when we fuse with a thought adjuster, this thought adjuster is a fragment of God. And this thought adjuster contributes to the partnership a phase of absoluteness. Not unlimited external absoluteness, but limited internal absoluteness. Secondly, God gives us personality. And among other things, this personality which we now have has capacity to penetrate the absolute level, but only in a sub-infinite manner. Let's adjust our thinking about the firehouse. The first floor is 2 inches high. The second floor is 3,200 miles high. No, don't, Bert. Leave it the way it is. You can't. The first floor is 2 inches high. The second floor is 3,200 miles high. The third floor has no ceiling. It just goes on and on. Now look, this is not a stalemate we're up against. This is not frustration. This is eternal growth. And the only alternative to eternal growth is growth that comes to an end. And if there were a ceiling on the third floor, and we could reach it, what then? Then we would be stymied. Then we could go no further. All you can do is choose, in your thinking, to accept infinity or to say, we're stymied. We're going to get someplace and then we've had it. I like the idea that we're never going to be stymied. I like the idea that we're never going to be stymied. We're always going to be able to keep on growing. And this is not frustrating, because I think this long, long growth, this endless growth, will have many, many milestones, many, many goal lines that we'll cross, and we'll have all the satisfaction of achievement and victory and the sweetness of success, a chance to sit down and count our blessings, and feel good about how far we've come, and not have to go on until we get itchy feet all over again. And then we say, well, I wonder what's beyond the next hill. See? We know darn well it's going to be a bigger mountain, but we climbed the last one. We've learned how to climb tall mountains.
Well, actually, you've learned how big, even here on this earth, you learn how to enjoy life.
Sure.
If you need to go around them, nobody likes you, you can go around.
Mm-hmm.
If you learn how to enjoy life here, sure, you'll have disappointments, but there'll be more joy all the way up than there will be.
Certainly.
So you're not going to suffer.
No. We're never going to be cramped for style. We're always going to be challenged with more ahead. That's right. The paper then goes on to kind of try to take off a total of totals. They say, now, look, all of this gets put together. We've got three trinities. We started with one. It's existential. We've developed two experiential trinities. And they present the concept here of a trinity of trinities. Not a trinity of three deities, but a trinity of three trinities. You see, in the beginning, God starts out with unity. And he keeps pushing it out into diversity. Then he reunifies the absolute in the universal absolute. He reunifies existential deity in the paradise trinity. Then he starts off on this tremendous experiential diversification. Just like opening up new subsidiaries, manufacturing new products. Now, he sets up the holding corporation of holding corporations. And as he did in the beginning, when he unified all existential deity in the original trinity, now he unifies all deity, existential and experiential, in a trinity of trinity. If the original unification of deity is the associative level, then I would call this the re-associative level. This is the total of totals. This trinity, we're told, not only is three across the bottom, but it goes up in three. I think of this trinity like a triangle. Can you see a triangle? Let's have a triangular firehouse, if you please. Leave the center pole out. We've got a triangle, and it's got a first floor, second floor, third floor. First level, second level, third level, to use the terms of the paper. On the first level, we have three trinities: existential, first experiential, second experiential. On the second floor, we have experiential deity, supreme and ultimate, and some form of the absolute. The third level is a little mysterious. Now let's think a minute. I think it's going to be kind of hard for the second experiential trinity to unify and to produce God the Absolute, as the first experiential trinity unified and produced God the Ultimate. See, the second experiential trinity is bucking infinity. I don't think they can make it. I think they're going to try. They're not going to make it. Way back in the foreword, when they're talking about these trinities, they point this out. And they say, this may not be altogether attainable, but they say the original trinity is an ever-present reminder that deity trinitization may accomplish what otherwise cannot be accomplished. And so, we project the sometime appearance of the Supreme Ultimate and the Trinitization of God the Absolute. Let's analyze that. Supreme Ultimate with a hyphen between it sounds like Father Son with a hyphen between them, doesn't it? When did the Father Son come into existence? When they trinitized the Spirit, right? They unified themselves. And it's been a tight partnership ever since. I think the Supreme Ultimate are going to trinitize God the Absolute. And that's how they're going to get him on the second level of the Trinity of Trinities. What kind of a God the Absolute is this going to be? Well, in terms of quality, God the Absolute is really going to be absolute. Because the Supreme is almighty and the Ultimate is omnipotent. And you put them together and that's a lot of power. But neither of them nor both of them are infinite. So while God the Absolute will be a bona fide personalization of an absolute God, this will still fall short of infinity. Because the Supreme and the Ultimate together cannot do what the Father and the Son can do. The Father and the Son are infinite. So the third person of deity is infinite. The Supreme and the Ultimate are powerful, but they are sub-infinite. And God the Absolute will also be sub-infinite. So while we can complete the second level, we can't complete it quantitatively. There's room for growth there. Thank the Lord. Because if there weren't room for growth, we'd stop growing too. The three absolutes are still external to this Trinity. The three circles. God the Absolute is a partial pullout of the Deity Absolute, but not a total pullout of the Deity Absolute. Supreme and the Ultimate can reach in there a long ways, but they can't reach all the way. So now we have God the Absolute existing in relation to the Deity Absolute, don't we? That's a new relationship. And we don't have a complete materialization of the unqualified absolute, because the cosmos infinite isn't finished, and it can't be finished unless it became infinite. So the unqualified absolute is still going to be hanging around all full of space potency, isn't it? And that's why I think when we try to figure who is topside at the top of the Trinity of Trinities, we're going to have to say it's the universal absolute. Now, let's just for kicks, let's assume the impossible. Let's say that you could exhaust infinity. Let's figure what theoretically would be possible. You know, the papers do this. They go back to a theoretical, hypothetical, static moment of past eternity, you know? They say, this is good for thinking purposes. Let's go that far ahead in future eternity. What we're trying to think about is the end of eternity, which is also the end of infinity. This is not real, but this is good for thinking purposes. If you could get all of the absolute pulled into this Trinity, you follow me? Then you would experientially have pulled the three circles together into one circle, and the whole absolute would be on the second level. And if that could be done, then the Father Infinite would be on the third level. And then it would become possible to know God as only the Eternal Son and the Infinite Spirit actually ever will know him, or ever do know him. That is never going to happen. That is the theoretical destiny of all growth. We'll never attain it, but we'll always be creeping up on it, getting closer and closer and closer, but never getting it. The paper goes on to say, now look, what we're talking about is infinitely remote. And yet, all of this is unified now because the Paradise Trinity unifies it all now. And if you're bothered by this, please remember, the only difference between the thing that is eternally remote in the future and now is time. And time is not real on the absolute level. To God, this is, even though to us, it will always be in the remote future. Now, I don't understand that, but I accept it because it feels good to me, but I can't explain. Certainly, certainly. I don't pretend to understand that, except I feel good about that statement. Because the only thing we've been talking about is time in our whole discussion. We've reached back into past eternity to get things started, and now we're reaching forward into future eternity to see where they end. And all of our language is time language, isn't it?
There'll be a time for
time. Yes, and I can't imagine that either.
I can't either.
I'm a creature of time. Right. Time and space and experience, we require to think. And yet, they imprison us within the frame of time and space and experience. And we cannot think successfully outside of that frame.
That's what they say, that when you think, you get on Corona or Paradise or something, where actually your spirit is trying to visualize not knowing someone that they are him. And yet they say, well, let's just in other words,
if it does,
I'm taking up that much space
in
front of your
eyes. We can't visualize
it's hard
that.
To visualize.
And that, I think, is why when they wake us up on the mansion world, they don't make us too different from what we are down here. The change is very small, very small. We're almost material, just barely not material. And I like that. Because I'm going to feel like me up there. You know, I'll be able to feel my arms and legs, and it'll feel natural.
Know someone else.
Yes.
I guess it is.
Well, here, we won't look precisely as we look down here. And the best illustration I can think of is they didn't always recognize Jesus immediately after the resurrection, but they recognized him very quickly. His personality tended to shine through however he looked. Mary thought he was a gardener until he spoke her name. And there was something familiar about that intonation. She knew who it was. You remember the two boys from Emmaus? It was the way he broke bread. When he stood on the dock and the apostles had been out fishing, they didn't know it was Jesus right away. They thought he was a fish merchant come down to buy the early morning catch. I'd forgotten what it was that made them suspect it was Jesus. And, oh, was it old Peter jumped overboard and swam ashore? Mm-hmm. No, we'll look pretty close to what we look like down here, but not exactly.
You will know it. Yes. But in a grass, it's so grass.
I think
that's
of that.
All the rest of
it's slow. Yeah. Each step is small. Each step is understandable.
Right now.
Yeah. Yes. 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 And don't they look good? Don't they look good? Because you're in there with about a jillion people.
I never did see it clear.
There can be an awful lot of people in Times Square. Well, that's what these two papers mean to me.
Well, I reckon it wasn't as far as I thought it was. I mean, I did comprehend it. I knew you were comprehending it.
I wish we could get this much out of paper when we read it.
Well, now, I'll tell you this, Michelle. I have been, as Bert were saying, the last full 5 lessons, because all the rest of me is clear up here, and I'm clear down here in kindergarten, and to me, I wasn't even interested.
Well, give it a try.
Well, I mean, I could pick up something.
Well, now say that again, see? Play that part of the tape over again and play it slow this time. Break it down into 1, 2, 3, A, B, C.
We can't do it. We tried it on this paper.
I'll tell you what you'll do for whoever is trying to explain. They'll learn an awful lot trying to make it clear.
They're not sure it is right,
if you ever get on top of this, you've got a key to the whole thing, to all the papers.
Well, that's what it is.
You'll unlock any door. There's nothing that will baffle you. Now, you may not understand all of what it's saying, but you will always understand part of what it's saying.
Well, you always pick up one or two points.
Sure.
I don't know. I fought with it for 2 or 3 years. I didn't necessarily fight
against it. I just
didn't agree with it if I didn't
understand it. Well, look how much more you know about forward now than you did. Well, I've had it for coffee every morning, and Mr. for coffee morning, noon, and night, but I was before you. I've been writing basically about these papers that we just talked about tonight for a long time. And I think what I'm trying to do, and what I have been trying to do in teaching the tough parts of the papers, you know, I'm just as interested in the life of Jesus as I am in the absolutes. Except you folks don't need help understanding the life of Jesus. And if I can be of any service to you, it's going to be over in this tough end, which is why I spend more time talking about it. But over on page 364, paragraph 4, there's a mighty messenger trying to make a point with us. Page 364, paragraph 4. There is a great and glorious purpose in the march of the universes through space. All of your mortal struggling is not in vain. We are all part of an immense plan, a gigantic enterprise, and it is the vastness of the undertaking that renders it impossible to see very much of it at any one time and during any one life. We are all a part of an eternal project which the gods are supervising and outworking. The whole marvelous and universal mechanism moves on majestically through space to the music of the meter of the infinite thought and the eternal purpose of the first great source and center. And to me, that paragraph says what all the hard parts of the book are about. And I guess it's my objective in life, as far as this book is concerned, to find some way of making these hard parts simple and understandable. Because the story is so wonderful, so beautiful, so grand, so enthralling, that I want to share it. I don't pretend to understand it, but my ignorance about it is well unified. And I would like to share that unification with you. You know, so that your ignorance will be well unified too. I don't know what the hell it means, I just know what I think it means. And I can explain that. But my whole feeling about the tough parts in this book are all in that paragraph. This is so big, so tremendous, that we don't begin to grasp. We don't begin to realize what lies ahead. It's so much bigger than the concept of any heaven that has ever entered the mind of man. It's really big, and it's really grand, and it's really thrilling. It's awfully exciting, I think. It's an adventure. It's an adventure, I think, that's going to tax our strength to the utmost, but never overtax our strength. I think they've got it figured how to stretch us just as far as we can stretch, but never beyond where we can stretch. And every time you stretch, you come out of it bigger. You know what I mean? You can do a little more. You've done some growing. And growing is a lot different from swelling.
I didn't hear it.
You know, growing is a thrilling experience. You ever stop and think? We grow inherently until we're about 25. Oh, sure, growth stops at about 20, but it takes 5 years to kill the momentum. Now, from 25 on, it's optional.
Not only that, but it's harder to comprehend.
Yes.
Something
that's right. But I think it's fun to keep on growing. Why stop?
It's a challenge.
That's right. You see, if you grow older without growing, life can get awfully dull. Because all you're doing is you're going down the shady side of the slope. But if you keep on growing, even the last half of life can be darn interesting and exciting. Because you begin to realize that all you're doing is winding up to get ready to play in a great big ballpark with a first-class team. Now, I've made my first half century. I don't think I'm ever going to make the second half century. I'm afraid it's going to do me in. Usually does, you know. And I'm pretty sure I'm past the crest of the hill. But because I think I'm growing and I'm trying to grow, I find life just as exciting as I did when I was 15 years of age. I still have eggs in my beard.
Well, when you lose sight of not being able to enjoy life, you're dead anyway.
Yeah, sure.
This book, though, I don't have anything to say about being ignorant about it because I don't give it a chance. All the time I ever keep it up is in fact of what I hear from Ed at home. Because I think it up and I'm like I am.
there thinking about taking her in out here to medical research to see what makes her go to sleep. She doesn't get enough air to her brain some way. She goes,
oh, they have a name for it.
Narcolepsy.
Yeah.
Fancy. Yes, I know about that.
So you see, we have an unusual personality among us.
You wake up
and realize you
didn't do
something you
didn't know you did. I told the man, I said, wait a minute, let me go to bed. Make sure I got it right before that you go. But you do
real well, aren't you? Yes. Sometimes I do, and if I'm wrong, I can't tell. Sometimes I got something wrong. I think that'd be wonderful to be able to go sleep at any time.
No, yeah. It isn't.
Because I have a hard time getting to sleep.
Well, it's...
I have wakelepsy.
I'd rather be able to take a sleeping pill and go to sleep. Do you come?
Yeah, I always think that.
Yes, yes, you can't be drunk too many times to keep awake. One, where now?
I've got a pill in Fort Worth that has that trouble.
Usage.
But that time we used to do was under the ministry.
duty as a human being? I don't think so. Don't forget that the entire Jesus movement was drawn from the Commonwealth of Israel. All these followers were Jewish except a few Greeks on the fringe. The entire start that Christianity got was drawn 100% almost out of the Jewish ranks.
Well,
the 12 apostles were Jews. The 70 were Jews. Abner was a Jew. Nicodemus.
He told them that if he had just broken completely with the Jewish tradition, maybe it would have had a...
But he loved those traditions. These were the things that he grew up with, that he knew as a little boy.
As a son of man.
Yes, of course, as a human being. Here, when you hear hymns sung, they're thrilling to you, aren't they? They're not to me because I never heard them sung. They're outside of my experience. And you love these things because they're what you heard when you were a child. You went to church. It's old and it's familiar. And don't forget that Jesus, as a human being, was just as much a part of his culture as we are a part of our culture. The Passover to Jesus was a perfectly natural thing to celebrate. Now, he celebrated it without the lamb because his theology argued against the sacrificial aspect of the Passover. But he would celebrate the Passover for the same reason that I enjoy celebrating Thanksgiving or Christmas or any of the other holidays, the 4th of July as an American. And to me, Thanksgiving would be a very poor Thanksgiving with roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. And yet in Canada, they celebrate the old English celebration of the harvest ingathering, and it's celebrated with roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. The turkey is an American form of celebration. Well, I mean, I'm just used to turkey on Thanksgiving. It seems right. I think Jesus conformed to the social custom. Not as a concession, because it was the normal, natural thing to do, and as a human being, I think he enjoyed it.
He was instructed to.
Yes, but I don't think there was any problem there. This is what he grew up with, and he was just as much a part of his day and age as we are a part of our day and age. Example, I don't think Michael could have wept over the city of Jerusalem. But Jesus, a Jew, certainly could weep over Jerusalem, knowing that his father's people had reached third base, and very few people ever got to third base, and they were going to die on third. This is a real tragedy.
You know, I'm glad you said that, though, because that is something else that I thought about. Why he's going to
weep. This was a Jew weeping.
You see, I still had an animal instinct of being the rule of rescue.
To what?
Well, that is in me. I said, well, let him.
But he knew. He knew the history.
No, I know.
He knew the history of the struggle.
He's inside. He's something that kind of.
Sure. Ah, but he knew that this was only a part of the group, and he understood why. It's because the Jewish people lost the great ideological battle that was fought out during the Babylonian captivity between the priests and the prophets. And now stop and think how difficult it was for the prophets. Think of the job Deutero-Isaiah had to convince the people who were in captivity that theirs is not a political mission on earth, that they're not to be a nation, that they are to be something more. Now, what American would buy that bill of goods? Now, please, 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 now, we're in Brazil. We're in captivity. And there are two groups, see? There are pastors, and there are some irregular people who didn't go to theological seminary. And the irregular people tell us that it's not too important whether we speak English or Spanish, and that we shouldn't rail against the conquering Brazilians who've got us working on their plantations down there. And we say, well, who are you, see? Now, our pastors who occupy our pulpits, they say, remember George Washington, remember Thomas Jefferson, and they appeal to our patriotism. They say, we shall go back and we'll rebuild Washington, and we will restore the Stars and Stripes to all its pristine freshness and glory, and we will be a people, free, each man sitting under his own vine, and no one shall trouble him. You translate this in terms of American patriotism, and then you can see what the priests were doing. And so they take all our traditions and they rewrite them to glorify the United States of America and to make us want to go back to America, to take boats from Brazil and come back and rebuild Washington. This is a parallel. This is a struggle between nationalism and internationalism. And the priests had nationalism on their side, and Isaiah had internationalism. Isaiah failed. And this meant that the whole concept of the Messiah was to come as a restorer of the American glories of Washington.
Wasn't that
Nathaniel Wheaton? I'm believing what? It was Mary Wheaton. No, Simon Zelotes. Simon Zelotes.
Inability to disassociate himself from nationalism. And
Simon Zelotes. Simon the Zealot.
The political and military situation that arose that caused the imprisonment of the Jewish race in Egypt, and briefly take that through that the time into the Exodus. Would you do that and tie time to it for me?
To the best of my memory, I will.
Entire time.
This will be simple because I've forgotten the details, but I remember the
process. It's quite simple, but I don't know.
The Jewish people came out of Egypt, a ragtag bunch of ignorant Bedouins.
Forgive me, Bill.
Yes.
Will you put a map for me?
All right. There were, from time to time, when drought would make the arid regions uninhabitable, there would be movements of the nomadic peoples from the less watered areas into the more fertile areas. This is a matter of climate cycle. Most of the great invasions that came out of Asia, Huns, Avars, Magyars, and so forth, Scythians, Sarmatians, they all got started because the rainfall gave out. And so people moved into better areas. We have these cycles right here in the Midwest. You had a drought cycle that ended, what, 5-6 years ago.
They immigrated to the Nile Valley.
Yes, now.
Of their own volition, they were there.
They were driven there by climatic change, probably. Now, they did not come as conquerors because the Egyptians were too strong. The Egyptians took them in as contract laborers. In other times, in other places. Yes. In an earlier age, other nomads called the Hyksos came into Egypt and they conquered and they ran the country for a while. These Semites, Arabs, if you please, that's one of the funny things about the fight between Jew and Arab today. The pure blood Jew is a Semite. Although many so-called Jews have no Jewish blood whatsoever. None. They're Khazars. We'll get into the Khazars in a minute. You want a story of the Jewish people?
Right.
I'll give it to you. And you won't be too proud of being a Gentile when I'm through. These people wanted out. The Egyptians took brutal advantage of them. They occupied about the same status as Negro labor in the South, except they were not a servile people. They were a people that had their own traditions of liberty, freedom, and fighting. They developed some cohesiveness, probably due to being organized for work on canals, public buildings, and the like. They were working on public buildings, probably in Egypt. They had a nucleus of leaders who had an Egyptian education. Moses,
probably was half Egyptian, half Jewish. Jethro and a few others also were educated men. They had as a background the traditions of the days of Melchizedek. Although the Jewish people were not strong believers in El Elyon. In fact, they didn't believe in much of anything. They were full of superstition, full of fears. Their religion was a very primitive sort of thing. I'm talking about the mine-run, illiterate, common laborer.
That was at the time of bondage.
That's at the time of bondage. About 1200 B.C., Moses made a break for liberty. Put down 1200. That's not a bad date. And forgive me on some of these dates because I'm calling them from memory. He made a break.
Moses started leading and started taking.
That's right. He waited until Pharaoh, the Egyptian army, was down around the third cataract in the south, fighting off the Ethiopians, the Numidians, and until the sea peoples, probably the same group that smashed Knossos in Crete, until the Dorians, the early Greeks, were attacking the Delta. The Delta is the mouth of the Nile. And when the Egyptians were working at both ends, Moses made a break for liberty, pursued for the household troops. Right. And I think the tradition of the Red Sea parting is pure myth. I think they just waited until they could outnumber the Egyptian armed forces, and they probably fought them off. Pretty well slaughtered the household troops. They made a break. They wandered around on the Sinai Peninsula. Moses, I think, was influenced by the teachings of Amenemope, who was an Egyptian leader, teacher, by the teachings of Ignatius. If you want to get a background of the moral climate of Egypt, get a book called The Dawn of Conscience by Preston. This is an analysis of moral teachings along the Nile. And as the book rested, The Dawn of Conscience. B-R-E-S-T. Maybe E-A-D. He's a very famous Egyptologist. It's in that book you will find the best account of the teachings of Amenemope, and also Preston Lallaire give you the Egyptian sources of the Old Testament writings.